The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So today I'd like to explore the topic of karma. This is kind of a big topic. We'll see how far we get, and also I'll try to kind of do a broad brush overview today. And as often for these morning classes, I'd like to open it for questions if something comes up, if you're not clear about what I'm saying, that please, you know, raise your hand and I'll take questions during the talk. So karma is a kind of a central teaching of the Buddha. It expresses one of the understandings that came to him during the night of his awakening. The core kind of understanding is one of cause and effect, that our actions have consequences, and that those consequences are kind of in line with the motivation behind those actions. So that's a kind of a very simple way to describe karma. This understanding, as the Buddha saw this, what he saw into, I think, essentially, was a natural law. Karma isn't something the Buddha invented. It's more like something he recognized as a way that reality is structured. The reality of our human experience is structured. There's natural laws that guide the way the universe works. There's the laws of gravity, for instance, you know, that it's not that Newton invented the law of gravity, right? I mean, he just describes something that was happening. There are laws of heredity. You know, you cross two things and you get a kind of a mixture of their genes. There are laws of the environment, of weather, laws of motion and inertia. And there are laws that describe or that laws that kind of govern, let's say, govern the workings of our minds. And so again, the Buddha didn't invent these, but he understood on the night of his awakening some very key principles about how our mind works. And those principles, he found, both explained why we struggle. One of the kind of poignant realizations that the Buddha is said to have had is that he looked out into the world and saw people wanting to be happy, really wanting to find happiness and to have ease and well-being in their lives, and actually doing the very things that keep them from having that well-being. A lot of that happens because, you know, we often feel, I think, in our lives, the ways we struggle, the ways we get caught, that these things kind of feel out of our control. You know, things happen in the world and we react. And it almost is like, you know, especially in our family of origin, you know, we get together in our family of origin and we do something and somebody says something and it's like, you know, these buttons get pushed, right? I mean, it's like, our family members, one friend of mine said, of course your family knows how to push those buttons. They installed those buttons. So there's that kind of sense of, you know, not having a choice so much about how we react when things happen in our environment. You know, somebody cuts us off on the freeway and poof, we explode. Or our family, you know, at our family, a family member says something and it takes us back to when we were 12 and we're reacting like we were when we were 12 again. A lot of these reactivities, now if we had choice, I mean, if we had conscious control over our minds, we would say, no, I'm not going to do that. But often we don't seem to have that conscious control. So these kind of patterns of reactivity are in play. Much of that reactivity kind of happens below the level of our conscious awareness. And it's like those buttons get pushed below the level of our conscious awareness, and it like sets that program into motion, and there we are reacting. So that, that subconscious reactivity is a lot of why we suffer. Because we don't see the kind of the subconscious choices that are made. You know, actually, people can't really push our buttons. They can't really reach into our mind and push that button. We essentially offer the button to them. So the workings of our mind, when it is below the level of the subconscious, you know, we don't see these choices that are being made to offer that button, essentially. You know, we don't see that we are choosing to expose ourselves to that reactivity. So because it's not seen, because it's below the level of our conscious awareness, the reactivity happens. And this is a lot of why we suffer, because we're not really seeing the origin of our reactivity. And we've practiced it a lot. Because we haven't seen its origin, we've practiced it a lot. One of the famous sayings of the Buddha is, whatever we frequently ponder becomes the inclination of our minds. So if we frequently engage in reactivity of a certain kind, that becomes the inclination of our minds. What we practice with our minds, we tend to experience more and more of. So the Buddha saw this pattern of reactivity. He saw essentially that we are pushing that button ourselves in a way, you know, pushing those buttons ourselves, but not seeing that we were pushing those buttons ourselves, not seeing that that is how our minds are doing what they're doing. So the law of karma basically explains a little bit about how that reactivity cements itself, how that reactivity tends to solidify itself. So, but also, and I'll just put this out there because it's important to recognize that the teaching of karma is not simply a teaching that explains why we suffer. It does that. It does explain why we suffer. But it also, it's a natural law, and basically, it says in a nutshell that if we engage in choice, making choices that are based out of greed, aversion, or delusion, we will suffer. If we engage in taking actions, making choices that are based in non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, that leads us more towards happiness. So the law of karma is kind of a neutral law in a way. It basically says what we reap, we sow. You know, that if we cultivate the conditions of skillful action, if we cultivate love, if we cultivate kindness, if we cultivate generosity, if we cultivate non-harming, if we cultivate mindfulness and concentration and wisdom, our minds will tend to move towards well-being, ease, peace, and happiness. Well, let's use the mics so the questions can be captured.
I have a question. What is the difference between because all human beings, they have a natural tendency to protect their interest. What is the difference between that and greed?
So what is the difference between the natural tendency for a human being to protect their interest and greed? There's a lot of overlap there. A lot of what we do in protecting our interests has to do with greed. For instance, we could take it to the level of, you know, businesses protecting their interests, their interests being financial, as opposed to the health of the planet, for example. And, a lot of protecting our interests is short-sighted, essentially. It looks at what is the near-term interest for me. And, you know, for businesses, it's profit this quarter, you know, rather than the long-term health of the environment. Let me keep going for a second. There's the sense of our protecting our interests in that sense as being quite entwined with greed. Now, the more we step into a bigger picture, and the more actually we see the consequences of acting out of greed. So, you know, this points to one of the reasons why it's so hard to step out of this cycle of reactivity and the cycle of the kind of karma that is based in greed, aversion, and delusion, because so often the consequences of that are not felt for a very long time. So, for instance, the environment, you know, the pollution of the environment. We've been polluting the air for thousands of years. And, you know, initially it wasn't that obvious. You know, it didn't seem like it was impacting the air. And in fact, at the time of the Buddha, it's kind of interesting to hear him talk about the air, the earth, and the water being, you know, kind of this untouched by human pollution. You know, he says, you know, you can throw excrement into the water and it doesn't damage the water. Maybe a small amount of excrement doesn't damage the water, but, you know, over time, with now, 7 billion people on the planet, it does. And the consequences of thousands of years of putting garbage into the atmosphere and into the land is now becoming apparent to us. And yet we've been acting in that initial self-interest, you know, to get, you know, it seems like, you know, well, this is within our self-interest, you know, mine all this carbon, the fossil fuels and burn it up and have electricity. And it seems in our interest. And yet not really experiencing the consequences of it until much more recently, really experiencing the consequences of it. And now experiencing the consequences of it, so many systems have been put into place because we have practiced that and we have gotten dependent on, our lives are structured around living in a certain way because of that, and so we tend to keep protecting those interests. So it's very difficult to step out of that. when we do start experiencing the consequences of something, we do start, it does start to help us to see a way out, although it's not always a pleasant way out or an easy way out. So kind of likewise with our own actions, with our own choices, our own protecting our own personal self-interests. Often we are protecting our personal self. So for instance, another protecting our self-interest might be lying to a friend, a small lie, you know, a little white lie, kind of, you know, when a friend calls and says, you know, do you want to do something? And, oh, no, I'm busy, or, you know, just a very small lie. You know, you don't particularly want to get together. No, I'm busy, or, you know, just a very small kind of thing. You know, so that comes out of a little bit, both perhaps of wanting to protect the other person from being hurt and protecting ourselves from having somebody think something unpleasant about us. there's that, you know, that kind of greed that is operating in that situation. Now that white lie may not have an immediate consequence. I mean, the immediate consequence of that white lie is probably relief. It's a sense of ease or peace or, you know, okay, I've got through that one. And you can extrapolate to other situations in your lives around like this. So, you know, you kind of get through that kind of situation and there's a sense of immediate, oh, that's okay. Now, you know, 6 months from now, that friend may discover what was going on. And then you feel the consequences of that. Then you might start to feel the consequences of that action. So when we start to feel the consequences of our actions, that's when we start to be able to make a change. Now, there is a kind of self-interest, to get back to your question, there is a kind of a self-interest that is kind of more organic, like, you know, taking care of the body, feeding oneself, getting a roof over our heads, that kind of thing. And so it is partly an exploration for us of whether there is contraction and holding and demanding a particular result from our actions, or whether there's more of a sense of open-hearted ease in taking action. So there's lots of different ways to go about fulfilling our basic needs, for instance. The, you know, getting the food we need and having shelter over our heads. Those kind of needs, or those kinds of, you know, protecting one's interest, can be acted on without greed, without aversion, without delusion. And the difference there, the difference really is to begin to see and to recognize what greed is in the mind and how it operates. Greed tends to demand a particular result. So I have to have that job, or I have to make certain amount of money, or I won't be okay unless I have that house or this big of a house or something, you know, so that there's the greed tends to have a demand to it about a particular outcome, as opposed to kind of almost accepting what's offered. So the part of the exploration around our meditation practice is to begin to understand what greed is in the mind, what aversion is in the mind, and what delusion is in the mind. And the more we understand that, the more we understand greed, aversion, and delusion, the more, actually, the more we begin to see that inherently those qualities of mind are not in our self-interest, because they create a state of suffering in their very existence. And that is essentially part of what our meditation practice begins to show us, that the meditation practice begins to make us less short-sighted. The meditation practice begins to reveal, like for instance in the example of the white lie to a friend, the awareness, the mindfulness begins to reveal the contraction, the sense of perhaps a little anxiety or fear that arises, and the recognition of the suffering of that in the moment. And so we begin to act with that more immediate feedback. So the mindfulness practice, along with some understanding, gives us more immediate feedback, which allows the whole process to go into a new direction, allows that unfolding of karma to move more towards the cultivation of happiness rather than the cultivation of re-grooving the reactivity. That was quite a long response to your question. Is there anything more you want to...
No, it was a great answer. I meant very small things. I meant that in the family, sometimes your family member asks you, trying to push you to do something that is not in your best interest.
So is there a question around that? Or?
Probably, yeah. I don't know. What's the reaction to that?
I'm sorry?
What's
the healthiest reaction when a family member is wanting you to do something that is not in your best interest? Hold your ground. Again, you know, knowing for yourself what is in your best interest. That kind of we get pushed from many, many forces in the world. And that's another reason why it's hard to break out of the cycle. Because, like, for instance, you know, going to our family of origin, you know, we can, one teacher calls this the foo, right? Family of origin. So let's shorten it to the foo. You go to your foo. You go to your foo, and that, no matter how much meditation you've done, you know, it's like, you know, you've gotten pretty calm in your work, you've gotten pretty calm in your, you know, your friendships, and you go to your foo, and it's like, you know, the forces at work in a family of origin are so potent. You know, they take us right back to the, you know, the time, you know, if it's with a, for me, with my brother, you know, when we get together, it seems like we go back to when we were about 12. You know, it's like the dynamic between us. It's very interesting to watch that happen. So you know, the family of origin has very strong pulls, and if you or when you start to hold your ground, one thing that seems to happen in family of origin is that when you start to hold your ground, they push harder, because it's like a system, right? It's like a whole system is at play. And if one cog or one part of that system starts to alter, the other forces in the system try to make sure that that alteration doesn't happen, because the family system tends to want stability. You know, it tends to want sameness, non-changing. So when we start to change, you know, it's like being skillful, knowing, you know, for instance, going to your family of origin. This is a hard place. Okay, I realize that when I'm walking into that situation, I'm walking into a situation that's going to pull me into my reactivity. So to kind of be aware of that and be on guard for that and take time away, you know, take time for yourself to reconnect with what you know is more in your best interest, as best you understand in this moment. So let's see, where am I? So one definition of the law of karma. Oh, well, let me just kind of state where I was before the question, which is that the law of karma basically both describes how we get caught in suffering and how we can free ourselves from suffering. Understanding how this law works helps us to make choices, move in the direction towards happiness, helps us to see, or helps us to at least understand how we get caught. And then the tools of mindfulness and wisdom allow us to, as I kind of described a few minutes ago, allow us to begin to see what's happening in our experience and to get more immediate feedback. We begin to be able to see into what we might have previously thought was below the level of the possibility of being conscious, and we begin to be able to actually touch into where some of those choices are coming from. So the law of karma, it's a neutral law, but it does give us the understanding that allows us to use that law more towards, to guide us towards happiness instead of suffering. So Bhikkhu Bodhi had a very concise definition. Now, it's kind of a dense definition, but it actually captures all of the key pieces of karma. So I'll say his definition, and then we'll kind of unpack it. So his definition is the capacity of our intentional actions to produce an ethically appropriate result. The capacity of our intentional actions to produce an ethically appropriate result. So take this apart. So the intentional actions are actions of body, of speech, of mind, are motivated by an intention. It's like our body doesn't just act by itself. Our body, we don't just speak. The mouth doesn't just speak by itself. There's a mental intention. There's a mental movement that precedes every single action of our body, every single action of our speech, and actually every single thing that happens in our mind, although that's much harder to see. It is, we can start to see that with meditation and mindfulness, but it's a good doorway into this teaching and this understanding is to begin to look at our actions of body and speech. So there's an intention behind those actions. You know, a simple example. We are sitting for a long time at a computer and doing work, and then thirst arises in our body, or we get thirsty because we haven't had a drink of water in a long time. Because of that thirst, there is an intention to get a glass of water. And because of that intention to get a glass of water, there's an intention to stand and walk towards the kitchen to get a glass and some water. So there's, you know, in even the very simplest actions, there's intention connected with the actions that we make. So the intention itself is kind of just a neutral impulse. It's that capacity. It's an energetic impulse, a kind of an energetic impulse. It's actually the intention itself is pretty neutral. Like, you know, that intention to stand. You know, there's an intention that motivates the body, that propels the body to stand. Associated with that intention is a motivation, is a reason why the action has been kind of motivated, affected. In the case of the example of the water, you know, the thirst is really the motivation, the thirst of the body. taking care of that. So that's a kind of neutral motivation. I mean, the body is experiencing a little bit of unpleasantness, but it's, you know, it's generally not aversion. It's not like strong aversion or greed that's motivating that. It's more like a bodily need. Now, another example from that situation, you're sitting at the computer, you know, you're working there, and the internet freezes. And so you're getting frustrated. Keep trying. More frustration. You keep trying. More frustration. The frustration builds, and you get up because you're so frustrated you just can't stand to sit in front of the computer anymore. So that example is a similar action, right? I mean, you're getting up to walk away from the computer, and you may even go to the kitchen, you know, get some food, soothe yourself, you know. It could be a very similar action, very different motivation, very different state of mind that accompanies that action. Now, this kind of pair of the intention that propels us into action and the motivation that accompanies it, that's where the Buddha really saw into this law of karma. That when that motivation accompanying that intention is based in greed, is based in aversion, is based in delusion, suffering will follow. Maybe it will follow immediately. Maybe it will follow tomorrow. Maybe it will follow years from now. Maybe it will be small suffering. Maybe it will be large suffering. But it will follow. When greed of, so this was the understanding that the Buddha came to. When we act with a motivation of greed, aversion, or delusion, suffering follows. This is expressed in the very first poem in the Dhammapada. All actions are preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All action is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a pure mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. So that those first two verses of the Dhammapada are really an expression of this law of karma. Sure. Use the mic, please. Use the mic.
All right. So, in that frustration example, in some ways, the greed to me would be to have everything the way I want it when I want it. You know, this sense of being able to control my external reality, or get my work done on time, or whatever it might be.
It could also be aversion. But the reaction could be greed or aversion, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So in that moment, usually for me when those kinds of things happen, frustration's the first thing that becomes real apparent. I mean, but that's actually suffering created by my grasping or whatever.
Yes.
I'm already in the suffering
yes,
at that
you are.
Point.
Absolutely you are. Yes. And that's what mindfulness begins to reveal.
Right. So that, right. So in that moment, given that that's, you know, generally where I am with my awareness, not to the proceed. I mean, I can check it back and sometimes that helps, but usually the frustration's pretty strong. So how to work with that in the moment? I can at least maybe choose not to get up or choose a skillful way to get up and do something that's helpful, like go for a walk or...
Yes.
tell the boss that it's frozen in a calm way.
Precisely, what, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
All right, because so, I can't yet get rid of that frustration.
No, and in fact, the movement or the thinking you can get rid of the frustration is
feeds,
yet more control.
Feeds the problem,
it's the same,
yeah.
Right, it's the same okay. process applied to seeing our minds.
So bringing love and compassion to the experience of frustration.
That's right, yes.
And that, allowing that to be there, like, oh, you poor thing. I mean, really, guys.
You know, there's different levels of that meeting. That I mean, and this is essentially where our karma begins to turn the corner, right? So when we can see a reaction, so yes, you're already in there. There's already been the reactivity put into place. It's like, you know, we throw a ball, right? And you know the there's already momentum going, you know, so it's like that frustration is launched, you know, that ball is already thrown, and so to deny that is to deny the reality of this moment, which is that that frustration has arisen, it is present. So the exploration in that moment is, can you meet it? The bringing love, bringing compassion, bringing wisdom to the experience. So being friendly to yourself, you know, of course you're frustrated. Look at this computer, you know, of course you're, you know, so bringing that sense of compassion and kindness and friendliness, bringing wisdom to it. This is just a mind state. This is just frustration. It is impermanent. Subject conditions. So, you know, bringing...
And it won't help.
Well, yes, and it won't help. So what's the purpose, right? I mean, to bring those to it, to bring the love, or the compassion and the wisdom to our experience, essentially both of those help us to be able to meet it. Help us be able to see it without following through on that pattern. So that's where, you know, that this practice really helps us, that essentially, you know, if you're acting on that frustration, you are looping back on the groove and making it stronger. If you can meet that frustration and allow it to be there, bring in some more skillful intentions of, yes, it is time to take a break. With a calm, yes, it's time to take a break. Yes, I will walk to my boss. I'll walk very calmly into my boss. So, you know, bringing some of that intentionality so that you're not acting out of that frustration, but acting more out of the sense of wisdom, out of compassion, out of friendliness. If you're aware of that frustration and cannot let that frustration guide the action, it will not regroove that in that moment. It will not regroove. And so what you are actually cultivating and encouraging in that situation is mindfulness, is compassion, is wisdom, is concentration, is confidence. So you're kind of regrooving the skillful, the wholesome, by choosing to act from a different perspective. So yes, it is, you know, you see that has happened. And this, again, you know, so that the witnessing of it, the meeting it with mindfulness, really begins to steer that into a different direction. And you can actually see that in the moment. The more continuous and the more clear the mindfulness gets, you can see a shift. You know, there's the frustration. You're caught in the frustration, and there's the sense of, oh, this is horrible, and oh, it's a big problem. And, you know, you're right in the midst of that. And then you recognize, oh, this is just frustration. Sometimes you can actually feel in that very moment some space, some ease, and in that moment experience the wholesome karma of the mindfulness. Yes. Yeah.
Feel gratitude, maybe even in that moment.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, so that that exploration of meeting our difficult mind states, that's what begins to give us the more immediate feedback, right? We do get the sense, I mean, when we turn towards mindfulness, with mindfulness towards that frustration, we get the immediate feedback, yes, this is suffering. This frustration creates tension in the body. It creates a mind that's contracted and feels like it's a big problem. And mindfulness shifts the environment. Now, initially, we may not feel that shift. You know, mostly what we may feel is the suffering of the frustration.
Well, often what I feel, the additional trap, is the aversion to the frustration and all the control then that comes on that,
yes,
which really escalates the suffering.
Absolutely.
But it's a repeated
It's a repeat pattern. It's a repeat pattern,
and
right.
So that's, for me, where the aversion comes in.
And you can just do that same thing with the aversion. Oh, there's frustration and I don't like it. That's what's happening. There's frustration and I don't like it and I want to be in control. Wanting to be in control, that's what's happening. So, you know, often we have to take step back before we can actually recognize, okay, that's what's happening. And sometimes we have to actually consciously bring in, take a breath, be compassionate to yourself, you know. So sometimes we have to consciously bring in some other mind states, or like say, wow, this is like leading into a rabbit hole. Let's put our attention someplace else. So we need to learn skillful means with that. So I wanted to do a little bit more to finish this part, because we only got 10 minutes left. So clearly this is going to be a multi-week talk. But that's okay. So this intention and the motivation, one of the key pieces around that I really want to emphasize is that when I say intention, often the use of that word in the English language brings up the sense of conscious choice, right? I mean, it sounds like intention is something we have control over, or something that we have a choice about. This intention that is the Buddha's discovery around karma, the intention and motivation, this intention is not necessarily even within the realm of our conscious awareness. This is, again, it's that very kind of low-level energetic impulse that precedes everything that we do, whether we're aware of it or not. So, you know, the sitting at the computer and getting up to get a glass of water, you may be, you know, in the kitchen drinking the water before you even realize you've stood up. You know, so you have not seen any of that intention happening. It doesn't mean that the intention wasn't there. Likewise, with the frustration example, you could easily be in the kitchen without ever having seen the intention to eat. You're just finding yourself in the refrigerator looking for something to eat. You know, you could easily be in that situation without having seen the intention or the motivation. So this piece, again, it's that the intentions that happen below the level of our subconscious awareness, those are the ones that are kind of more, I was going to use the word dangerous, and in a way they are, because those intentions tend to be the ones that are motivated by habits, by patterns, by how we've been conditioned in our lives. And they're like we're acting on autopilot, you know, we're just doing our thing. And those intentions that are below the level of our subconscious awareness, they're coming out of our programmed, all those buttons that were installed by our families and our friends when we were kids. And, you know, so it's like we're responding based on our habits, when we're not aware, when we're not consciously aware of those infinitely small moments of choice. There's these moments of intention, these moments of intention. It is choice happening. It is a choice that's being made. And this is actually a place where karma meets the teaching on not-self. Because, you know, if you could see those choices and make a choice, you probably would not choose to get angry or, frustrated or to have those states arise. You probably would choose otherwise. The conditioning of our lives, the ways that we've been interacting, the reinforcement that we've got to behave in a certain way, all of that is kind of like a program that's running, and we talk about running on autopilot. You know, it's like there's not a self making that choice. It's the conditioned nature of your mind making that choice. So when we're not aware, our habits are making our choices for us. We can say it that way. That when we're not aware of what's going on below that horizon of the subconscious, our habits are choosing. There is choice being made, and it's being made by this automatic program. Now, when we bring mindfulness to this process, now there is also times when we can consciously see, you know, well, do I want to do this or do I want to do that? And so there are times when that intention and motivation are present in our conscious awareness. You know, we can see, for instance, especially with a little bit of practice of mindfulness, we can start to see a little bit of a skew coming out of our mouth when we're going to say something to somebody and see, there's a little unfriendliness coming out there, so maybe I could not do that. So we can see sometimes when there's an unwholesome or an unskillful motivation, motivating an action, and choose to say, I don't think I'll do that. Or we're, on a diet or something, and, we find ourselves at the refrigerator getting ready to have that piece of cake, and it's like, wait a minute, let me stop. So we there are times when that intention and that motivation can be seen. With mindfulness, with the practice of mindfulness, essentially what begins to happen is that we see more and more, so that the mindfulness begins to reveal those moments of intention leading to action. It reveals the intention and motivation to our conscious awareness. And so, for instance, the frustration example, if you're unaware, if you're on autopilot, you're probably going to get up out of frustration and you're already in the kitchen getting that whatever to soothe yourself. And you've acted on that frustration. You're already there. You've already acted on it because you didn't see it. And I think, as you've seen, you now can see it, right? You can see it arising. Mindfulness gives us the capacity to see, oh, there's frustration. Oh, maybe I can meet this. Maybe I don't have to blindly follow that program. So essentially what happens here is that mindfulness becomes a new program. We're, cultivating a new program, developing a new way of meeting experience. It's no more I or me or mine than the habitual responses. And yet that awareness, the mindfulness, what helps happen there is it reveals the suffering nature. It reveals the way greed, aversion, and delusion in the moment are suffering, already suffering. Frustration is already suffering. When the mind sees that, when mindfulness allows the mind to see that, you know, the mind doesn't want to suffer. You know, it thinks, the mind, when it's not, you know, present and when it's acting on autopilot, it thinks that having that piece of cake is going to make it feel better. When it sees the frustration for what it is, it realizes that the ending of the frustration is what's going to make it feel better, and that that frustration can end simply because it's an impermanent phenomenon. It can go away. It doesn't have to be followed through on to go away. We don't have to act on our frustration to have the frustration go away. We can observe the frustration. And this is what our practice of mindfulness really begins to show us. Again, leading us in a new direction. And with that, I think we need to stop. I'll keep going next week. I'll have to summarize this first part again next week, but that's okay. A little review of karma is not a bad thing. So thank you for your attention.